Blog Talk Radio.
I'm expecting some music at this point. I don't know.
Okay. I wonder if there's anything I can do about this lack of music here at the beginning of the show.
What's happened to us?
I don't know.
That's all right. Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we're all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Well, hi, Phil.
You were...
What about hearing now?
Yeah, baby. Okay.
We see, I'm like Shaft. I get my own theme song, you know, when I walk into the room, and that's exactly what happened.
I'm just talking about Stephen. What? Oh, fair enough. All right. Well, I didn't
shut
know
your mouth.
Yeah, shut your mouth. So that is like Stephen's theme. So, yeah, the show really feels naked with that. Yeah, you know, it's like you ever you're dressed fairly nice and then realize you forgot to put a belt on.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
it's that feeling, right? It's like, how can we do this show without that? That is the belt, okay, of the show.
That's right. It'd be like wearing a tuxedo T-shirt without a belt. I mean, that's
a tuxedo T-shirt without the fake ruffles on the shirt. So that's what I think. So anyway,
yeah,
always good to get those out of the way as quickly as possible. How are things going for you?
Excellent. I tell you, this week is kind of crazy at work, and I'm glad to, get home, be able to unwind, and this show is a big part of that. So, yeah, particularly when things are wild at work, it's good to have a hobby, and this is one of many.
Absolutely, this is that's a good place to go. Good,
where everybody knows your name, right?
Where everybody knows, and you got your own theme song, so it's. it's a good deal all the way around. Well, we've got a fun show tonight. We're going to be talking about various items that kind of bring the future into focus for us. So our general topic is the future in focus. And before we get to that, any interesting developments? Anything going on that we should just be talking about generally before we leap into our topics?
I don't guess so. As a father, I got to say that I'm very thankful. I had a son that had an accident yesterday, and I'm going to tell you when something that could have been bad turns out to be not so bad, makes you thankful, And,
that is a tremendous feeling of relief, absolutely. So he's okay? What happened?
Yeah, he got out and he was fooling with a trailer that, he's a 7-year-old kid and we had this trailer that was a loaned trailer and it was sitting out behind the house and it's one of these things with a kind of the back door of the trailer lets down like it's a ramp to drive a four-wheeler up into.
Right.
And that door is like a 50-pound door. And he's out there, messing around with the latches on it and manages to undo it, and the ramp comes down on him and ends up with a big old knot on his head and laceration to his chest that's not too bad, no stitches needed. And, with worried parents, we end up in the emergency room and everything, but he turned out to be just fine, and so we're mom and dad are very happy that he is okay. So,
That's good. Glad to hear that that all's well. Scary moments there.
Every parent has them.
Oh yeah.
Sometimes it's bad, and so absolutely, we're very thankful that it wasn't. So, I hate to start the show on a downer topic, but I guess it's not too downer.
Well, not downer, that everything worked out okay. That's the that's the important thing. Well, I've got one thing. I wanted to tell you that, I'm listening to all of our original shows as we're running these archived programs on Monday evenings now. For those who don't know, Fast Forward Radio is now on 3 times a week. We're on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Saturdays. And so I was listening to the third show we ever did on Blog Talk Radio on Monday. Actually, I listened to it the day before because that's how I prepare for making my insightful commentary that really kind of ties the whole thing together. And this was interesting because we finally got the count. According to me on that show, and I had forgotten this, that was the 18th Fast Forward Radio we had ever done.
Okay.
And it was it was the third Blog Talk Radio, so that means that we had done 15 shows before we ever started this.
Okay. And how many have we done since we've been with Blog Talk Radio?
I don't know. But now we can figure that out. See, that's
Now we have a way of determining that. So
yeah.
I don't think we've missed. Have we missed any weeks? It seems like we may have missed one or two weeks in the entire.
We have over the 3 years. We have missed 1 or 2 weeks, but we've done at least 1 week where we did two live shows. So we're very close to almost perfect. If you figure it started in the middle of October, that would be 3 years is 156, plus this is a month later, 160. I'd say we're right at we're right around 175 shows. We're very close to 175 total Fast Forward Radios that we've done.
And they've been fun. I mean, that's the reason we continue doing it. I mean,
that's exactly
every
right.
time, if it stopped being fun, we'd stop doing it. So, so that's kind of the deal.
I don't know. I got my contract to think about, but.
I hope you're being paid more than me, Phil.
I'm being paid about 1,000 times as much as you, Stephen. That's
that's right.
And yet you're being paid 1,000 times as much as I am. That's the odd part about it. That's where it gets really weird. So the other thing that was fun about that show was, we had two callers that night. Back when we were taking callers before the pranksters ruined having people call in, we had Carl Hollowell call in, who actually didn't want to be on the show. He just wanted to hear, and he couldn't hear, so he called in, and we brought him out and ended up talking to him. And Matt Doing. And I think that was the first time we met Matt, who's been a stalwart of the chat room for 3 years. So it's kind of cool to hear our old friends. I mean, Carl, we've known him for years and years, leaving comments on the blog, and he had a lot of great stuff to say. We should have him back on as a guest one of these days. I think one of the cool things about reflecting on these shows is we probably get some good ideas for shows going forward.
Absolutely.
Because it
gives
us sort of a future focus, if you will.
Exactly. I was about to say, we need to get focused on the future at some point here. Absolutely.
Well, let's begin. Let's begin with our poll this week, and we'll talk a little bit about some of your scandalous commentary that you left on my post about scientific evidence for precognition. So, for those who haven't read the post, this is very interesting. This has been making the rounds. I assume, Stephen, you've seen it more places than just the Speculous. In fact, I'm pretty sure you probably tweeted about it.
I had. I had tweeted about this. And did you pick it up from the tweet, or did you see it just out there making the rounds?
I don't know where I got it. It's one of those. By the time I've finished the blog post, I'm not quite sure. I had seen it several places, and then I did a Google search and grabbed it myself because I kept bumping into it. It's one of those things. The first like two or three times I saw the headline, I paid no attention, and then finally I read the story, and I'm a little bit intrigued by the thing, I have to say. And what makes it interesting to me is not that tests have been done, apparently scientific tests, which seem to show some kind of paranormal phenomenon or some kind of psychic ability. There actually have been tests in the past that have shown those things. Princeton Engineering Anomaly Research, PEAR Labs back in the 90s, did some really interesting research with Ganzfeld, what do you call those, like the this kind of sensory deprivation subjugation of the people who were taking the test, and scored some pretty interesting hits on people having psychic ability, and apparently demonstrated a very mild psychokinetic effect. But the long and the short is that the methodology is always called into question. So these are what we have to call extraordinary claims. Even the claim of a mildest of mild psychic effects is an extraordinary claim, right?
Right.
If you're claiming a precognitive ability that gives you a 1/10,000th of a greater than chance likelihood of being correct, it rewrites everything. It's
right. And the reason is, I mean, cause leads to an effect. It does. It's not supposed to work the other way. If it works the other way around, then science doesn't really work. You know, as science as we understand it doesn't really work. And so
that's right. Because what you have happening, if effects can precede causes, is you have something happening on the macro level, at our level, which apparently happens all the time at the quantum level, and everyone's perfectly comfortable with that. But which is not supposed to happen at, you know, anything larger than like the particle level. It's certainly not supposed to happen with these major interactions. We're not supposed to be able to anticipate the future. There's no way to see the future from our standpoint, according to physics. And if that's really what's happening, then it calls so much into question. So it's an extraordinary claim that requires extraordinary evidence, and I absolutely agree with that principle. I'm sure eventually James Randi will have some commentary on this after the thing is published, and it'll be interesting to see if this Dr. Bem goes for the million with Randi. But here is this guy Daryl Bem from Cornell University. Here's what impressed me about this story. Two things really stuck out for me about this. One is the methodology that he used, which I thought was brilliant, which was he didn't try to create new experiments for determining psychic phenomenon. Instead, he took existing memory experiments and just flipped the time order. So
right.
Methodologically, these should all be correct. These should all be sound experiments. There should not be major issues with them. So that's I think that's a very clever approach, and I think he's to be commended for that part of it anyway. And the second thing is, he ran these for 8 years and sat on it. He came up with a result that seemed to show something 8 years ago, and said, "I better keep checking," and continued working on it for 8 years before he felt comfortable publishing.
You know what he was trying to avoid?
What?
He was trying to avoid the lecture that Peter Venkman got in Ghostbusters, Dean Yeager in Ghostbusters. Of course, Peter Venkman is doing these exact kind of tests, trying to prove psychic phenomenon, Mostly he's trying to hit on the
I was going to say, wasn't Peter skewing the results in favor of hot girls over, irritating guys who...
Exactly.
Who were actually scoring better? Yeah,
he was electrocuting the irritating guys to get them to leave the room,
right?
In favor of the pretty girls. But anyway, so Dean Yeager comes, as he's kicking Dr. Venkman out off the campus, of NYU. He says, "Dr. Venkman, the purpose of science is to serve mankind. You seem to regard science as some kind of dodge or hustle. Your theories are the worst possible kind of popular science." Your methods are sloppy and your conclusions are highly questionable. You are a poor scientist, Dr. Binkman. You know, that is...
He didn't
want to
get that, you know?
Yeah, he didn't want to get that. He was trying to avoid that lecture.
Like NYU, yeah. Cornell is a highly prestigious institution, and he didn't want to get drummed out of Cornell like that. I think you're doing a real disservice that you keep bringing Peter Venkman up, actually, because I think if anything, the patience that this guy has shown in waiting 8 years and the rigor he's applied to his methodology indicates that this guy is no Bill Murray.
Well, either that, or you know, that's 8 years of working within the institutional situation. So anyway,
riding the gravy train
for 8 years. I don't know this man. I have no axe to grind against him. I'm sorry.
I know. We're all having fun here. But I think that what's very telling is that the paper is being published not in a journal of parapsychology, but in a legitimate psychological journal. Now,
yeah.
As I point out in the blog post, but I'll say it again here, just as the fact that he's got these results doesn't mean there's any psychic phenomena going on. The fact that he's at Cornell, that he waited 8 years, that he used a rigorous methodology, or that he's being published in a sound, respected journal, none of that makes it true. Right.
Right.
It gives him an air of credibility, but ultimately it comes down to what do the tests show? Was the methodology sound? Is there some way that this effect can reasonably be explained short of psychic phenomena? Because Occam's razor insists that if there is a simpler explanation, that's probably the correct explanation. And a simpler explanation would be some flaw in the interpretation of the results, some flaw in the methodology that he used, or, out and out faking of the results.
Well, here's what I would like to know. I would like to know, is it double blind? And the reason, and here's the reason why. Without, the reason double blind is so important in scientific studies is, not only the image that these people were guessing at needs to be a surprise not only to the test subject but also to the person who's giving the test. Because if you're looking at a card, if I'm looking at a card it's the Five of Clubs, and you. Phil are sitting across from me, and I have you guess that card while I'm looking at the card. You know, if I do that enough with you, you may get to a point where you can read me. I don't have the world's greatest poker face, and so maybe there's a point which you can figure out. You can have a slightly better than 50%. If it's a 50-50 shot, you might have a slightly better than 50% chance of guessing the card just because I get to see the card.
See, my response to that is surely in the original tests that were designed to check for memory,
right.
That exact same risk would exist and should have already been eliminated via some kind of double-blind methodology. I would think it's procedurally built in that it would almost have to be, or else you'd have to say, gosh, all those memory tests they ran all those years were flawed for exactly the same reason.
Right.
So. But it's an excellent point. You know, is there something in the methodology that slipped past everyone's notice, and is there something so subtle going on that we aren't able to put our finger on it, but that is still somehow tipping these people off?
Right.
And some of the experiments, I mean, it just sounds so straightforward and automated. The one where we got into the discussion about the erotic imagery, where you're trying to predict what position the model is going to be in the next picture. And, that's the one where they achieve something like 53% hit rate, which
right.
doesn't sound huge, but I noted with great interest in the New Scientist article that's about the same hit rate that is experienced between taking a daily aspirin and not having a heart attack. And
okay. Yeah.
And everyone believes that that's a legitimate, scientific, valid effect, right? We don't say it's 100%, but we say there's definitely cause and effect there, and there's something going on. Now you gave him a hard time about using the erotic imagery, but my response to that was also twofold. I said, well, one, again, if that's what the original test was, he's just replicating that. And two, oh, yeah, you said it sounded more like Peter Venkman than Stephen Hawking, and I had to remind you that who was it he had that bet with? Stephen Hawking had a wager with some other major scientist back in the – you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. In fact, it's funny. He has done two scientific bets. Stephen Hawking has made two scientific bets, and he's lost both of them. I think that's interesting to me. He bet in 1975. He bet cosmetologist Kip Thorne a subscription of Penthouse magazine for Thorne against 4 years of private eye for Hawking that Cygnus X1 would turn out not to be a black hole.
Ah, right.
Okay. And what's interesting. It would have been good for Hawking's career if it did turn out, if Cygnus X1 had turned out to be a black hole, because Hawking, so much of Hawking's theories are, you know, revolve around black holes.
Right.
And so,
but he bet that
betting
it would
against
not.
It being a black hole is sort of a hedge. You know,
yeah,
he's like,
yeah, exactly.
Saying,
so it's like his career gets destroyed, but he gets that.
But at least I get, you know, to read 4 years of Private Eye while I'm waiting for my career to recover. So, any rate, I guess that's the deal. And then he made exactly. You know,
once again, you know, he demonstrates.
He's brilliant. Yeah. So he lost his bet and his career took off. So I mean, there you are. And then again, he bet in 1997 he made a bet with John Preskill on the on information surviving black holes. You know, does information survive black holes? And he bet, let me just read this here. Hawking and Thorne, Kip Thorne again, bet that information must be lost in the black hole. Preskill bet that it must not. The stake was an encyclopedia of the winner's choice from which information can be recovered at will. Hawking conceded the bet in 2004, giving a baseball encyclopedia to John Preskill. He kind of let Hawking off the hook. He could have insisted on, you know, a leather-bound Encyclopedia Britannica, I guess, but he wanted a baseball encyclopedia. So, anyway, that was that bet. And so, there have been a lot of interesting scientific bets over the years, and Hawking, being a brilliant scientist, has participated in two and has lost two. So there you are.
How about that? That is interesting. Well, so no precognitive points for Stephen Hawking, that's for sure. Now in the survey that I ran, I asked first, is it possible that these test results indicate real precognitive capability in the test subjects? And the choices were yes, no, or not sure. Stephen, how did you respond?
I'm sorry. Say that again one more time, Phil. I was reading something just now.
Oh, is it possible that these test results indicate real precognitive capability in the test subjects?
I said no. Now this is me being an old fuddy-duddy. You know, this is one of these deals where, you know, when some old guy says there's just no way, it turns out he's very probably wrong. Well, maybe I'm being the old guy this time, you know. Because it really turns over so many fruit baskets as far as what we understand about how things work in this universe. So if it turns out to be wrong, then, you know, even just in a small way. And we have something pretty weird going on there, and I guess it may come down to quantum effects in the macro universe, which would be weird. So
I agree with you completely, but I had to say yes because I think you can't rule out that it's possible.
Yeah.
You know, it seems vastly unlikely to me that that's what's happening, but I don't think it can be completely ruled out. Okay, next question was, what is the most likely explanation for these test results? And the choices were subjects seeing the future, a flawed design of the test, a flawed interpretation of results, faked results, or other.
I thought it was probably a flawed design of the test. So,
I believe I put flawed interpretation of results. But
I think the theory is the worst kind of popular tribe. Methods are sloppy, and conclusions are highly questionable.
Right. You've beaten that horse. That's excellent, actually. You know, never let a good joke go to waste, right? You just gotta, you gotta keep coming back to it. I think that this is where I got into some trouble with Wayne Rudinsky, who I had posted this survey up on Facebook, and he wrote me and said that you're asking us to state opinion about matters of fact, not opinion. And I told him that that's right, since we don't have the facts, all we've got are opinions, but that I think that I avoid that conundrum by talking about what's likely. So
yeah.
I'm not asking anyone to say what the facts are. I'm just saying, what do you think is the most likely explanation for this? We don't know. People could actually be seeing the future.
I'm very comfortable with the way you put it because, I mean, for example, in a courtroom, when you're determining what really happened on a day in question, that's all you have. You know, at the end of the day, you have to make a determination based on what's more likely than not that happened in the case of a civil trial, but in a criminal trial, you have to, you have beyond a reasonable doubt as your standard. But at any rate, it comes down to what is your opinion about what probably happened. So,
right. Now, the next one is an opportunity to have some fun and speculate because I wrote, if the results pan out, what is the most likely explanation of the precognition? And the choices are being a good guesser provides evolutionary advantages, time doesn't work the way we think it does, the quantum nature of consciousness, our souls or spirit are not constrained by time the way our bodies are, there is no explanation, probable or otherwise, or other. And you said?
Quantum nature of consciousness.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
So if it were to occur, it would be because consciousness is, as Penrose says, occurring at the quantum level, and somehow we're able
somehow
to...
Our brains are somehow, in a mild way, quantum computers or something. Because, not too many people really think that, but there has been some speculation that there's some quantum effects going on in our brains. So, anyway, I would have to fall back on that if it were to pan out. I'd have to, start there for an explanation.
Yeah, I think so. I wrote, actually, I think I chose the first one, being a good guesser provides evolutionary advantages. And then after I chose that, I left a comment saying I shouldn't have had that as a choice.
Yeah, that's really an unfair
choice. Because what
does
being a good guesser mean?
Yeah.
If you're somehow getting over 50%, there's still something mechanically making that happen, right? There's no way to be a quote-unquote good guesser, right? That's either you have information or you're somehow seeing into the future. So I think that one is a dodge. Although if we did develop that ability, if that is something that we somehow evolved, that would be the explanation.
Yeah.
And you can see where it would be a tremendously helpful thing to have up to a point.
I would combine my answer and say with your answer and say the quantum nature of consciousness provides an evolutionary advantage. So,
yeah. There you go.
Anyway.
So
okay, that was pretty cool. That was an interesting interesting survey about an interesting subject. I would like to know how this turns out after there's more peer review and see how it's received.
It will be interesting to see if anything comes of it or not. If either a serious critique is mounted that he's not able to overcome with subsequent research, or if the whole thing just kind of fizzles, which is equally likely. But we'll see. It's intriguing that even as our knowledge of the universe increases and our scientific knowledge increases, we still don't know for sure about some of these other things, and I guess never will, or aren't likely to for a long time to come. That there, you know, there are still these fringe possibilities that that some people are looking at, and that will continue to be explored, and I think will continue to, if nothing else, generate some pretty intriguing discussions over the years.
Absolutely.
Okay, so what else we got, Stephen? I know you've been Mr. Tweetmeister this week. What have you got that's going to bring the future into focus for us this evening?
Yeah, I've been tweet-tastic. I mean,
tweet-tactic.
Anyway, I thought it would be interesting to talk about this idea that is being proposed for Mars. Here's the idea. It apparently, if we bought one-way tickets to Mars instead of a round trip, apparently you get a huge you have to explain this to me why this would be the case, Phil. But according to their numbers, it cuts mission costs by 80% if we go without the idea that we got to come back. If we go and just set up camp and, you know, just hang out there the rest of our lives, you know. It cuts emission costs by 80%. I wonder why that would be. You know, I mean,
logic would tell you maybe 50, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, where's that other 30% coming from? I think.
I guarantee you, if we cut weight down by whatever weight is saved by not having to have return fuel, I would want that much filled up with cargo. You know, if I'm going to be staying on Mars forever, you know, I better dang well have some cool stuff in that ship that
I think that must be it. I think that you can probably bring all the cargo you need at a significantly lower weight mass than all that fuel. And it's not just the fuel to escape the gravity well of Mars, it's the fuel to enable the deceleration of all that fuel to escape the gravity well of Mars. So I guess it's those two factors combined. You're taking a much lighter load to Mars, and then you're not having to blast off from Mars, and those are going to be huge savings. Now, you're incurring costs. The costs you're incurring are all the infrastructure that you have to put in place that are going to enable people to stay alive once they land on Mars. And obviously the thinking is that there will be a follow-up mission at some point. They'll send more people to Mars, and that someday people will be able to bridge the gap and go back. But what's the projected timeline for the – is it part of a greater program? I mean, obviously it's not a one-off thing. How do they project the timeline unfolding?
Well, it's basically they're saying that the scientists that are looking in this direction are saying we could get up and going faster if we planned it just for a one-way trip. We could do it much faster and much cheaper and everything. NASA wants nothing to do with it, apparently. The powers that be at NASA says, you know, we part of the deal was getting a man to the moon and bringing him safely home within this decade. You know,
right.
that was the deal, as John F. Kennedy said. So that's what they want to do. Apparently it's not a done deal for NASA unless we can also bring you back home. And I understand that. I'm sure every astronaut that has flown with NASA appreciates the priority being that they could come home. But when we're talking about colonization, people that got on the boats in England and headed for the New World, they were cutting all ties. They really believed that they were. You know, most of them believed they would never see England again, and so that led obviously to the country we live in. So I don't know. I guess in one way you're ensuring when you do it that way with the idea we're never coming home. You're ensuring that we don't have with Mars what we had with the moon, which was, you know, basically we plant a flag and we come home and we don't go back for years and years and years. If
right.
you're actually sending people there and they're putting together the infrastructure, they're living the remainder of their lives there, then, it's going to be a much bigger deal. Mars will Mars will be a much more important place for humanity if we have a permanent presence there. And I guess that's the thought. So.
Well, I think so. I think it's open-ended if you do it that way. If the priority is always send someone to the other body and bring them home, you're implicit in that model is that these are self-contained one-off things. This is not an expansion of human presence into these new places as much as it is an excursion, right? It's a temporary venture. That's the word temporary. Right, it's the difference between doing something temporary and doing something permanent. Those are the two models that are conflicting there, and you know that idea was proposed for the moon. In the 60s, when we were scratching our heads and saying, "How are we going to get to the moon? How are we going to beat the commies to the moon?" There was an awful lot of discussion about what the right model was going to be. Do we do Earth orbit rendezvous? Do we do lunar orbit rendezvous? And some crazier ideas that were proposed. And one of the first and craziest was one-way trip. We'll send a guy up there. We'll get a moon base going. 18 months later or so, we'll have another rocket. We'll send some other people up, you know, get some relief or something. But just the whole idea being that we would create a permanent presence on the moon, starting with the first guy who got sent there. And we didn't do that, but we did not abandon that idea for lack of volunteers.
There would have been somebody who would have done it. Yeah.
There were people willing to go, and there are people willing to go on this Mars mission too. So that I think that's the answer to NASA's, you know, we're protecting the astronauts and we'll always send them home. It's like, well, for one thing, of course it would be a volunteer thing. You know, no astronaut is going to get sent to Mars for the rest of his life against his or her will. But there are people.
Even the annoying astronaut that nobody likes, you know.
Even the worst of the astronauts isn't going to be subjected to that. But there are people, qualified, capable people, willing to make the trip. And willing to say, I'm ready to take that risk to open up Mars, to move humanity to Mars. And, you know, that is, I think, a tremendously heroic and noble sentiment. I don't know if it's smart. I don't know if that's the right approach. But I know that when someone says that they're willing to do that, and you believe that they really could pull it off, given the, given the right infrastructure and given the right mission, that's awesome. I mean, you look at that and you go, how can we not do that if it's possible to do it? So I feel that's the most appealing answer. I don't know if it's the right answer. Maybe NASA's right because it's easy to talk about how noble and heroic it is when you're talking about somebody else's life. But when that person is talking about doing it, I don't know. I'm conflicted. You're the personal injury attorney, Stephen. What do you think? What's the correct answer here?
The correct answer is let's send some old guys.
I'm sorry.
Let's send some old guys.
Okay. Why old guys?
Well, for one thing, when you send young people, particularly if they're within the period of time in their life where they would. In the case of a woman, bear a child or father a child if you're a man, and you take the kind of radiation that you would take between here and Mars, you're likely to have some problems. You either sterilize your be sterile or have some pretty bad mutated genes, and so. There's that issue.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. Also, the issue of cancer from all the radiation. If someone takes a big enough dose that they're going to die of radiation poisoning in 10 years. Send a bunch of 60-year-old guys that take that kind of radiation dosage, and they can they can spend 5 or 10 years on Mars building the infrastructure for a colony and die of cancer there on Mars. So it sounds cruel, but again, these are volunteers. These are people that want to be known as the fathers of a new planet. You know, the founding fathers. You know, and so, hey, there. You know, we make choices all our life between whether we want an easy happy life or a consequential life. You know, I mean, if somebody who has the ambition to be president, I can't imagine a job that would be more, I don't know, in some ways it's miserable.
Sure.
You run for president and immediately half the country hates you.
Right.
So, some, and in the case of our present president and the one who preceded him, more than half.
Yeah, we seem to be building up larger and larger coalitions against
the people who hold
the office. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, but these are people that they have this ambition, and part of it comes down to we want to live a life of consequence. We want to.
Right.
We want to have done something. We want to
right.
have made a name for ourselves, and so, you can. And these are some, these guys that would volunteer for that. That's what they would want to do. And so, if it really does advance humanity at the same time, hey, give them the shot. I think it's a great idea. I wish that NASA would show a little intestinal fortitude sometimes and try something a little bit out of the box. And this would. Certainly qualify for that.
I think that would definitely qualify for outside of the box, and it would have some of the old spirit. But I think your points about radiation are well taken. And in fact, when I look at it from the standpoint of having heard your comments, the issue isn't really so much about leaving people alone on Mars to fend for themselves. The issue is we got to figure out something to do about all that radiation.
Yeah.
Because
really
long term, that radiation is still going to be there, and ultimately, if we're going to open that planet up and we're going to be able to send people from here to there and back, and young people go, and either way, for it really to be viable that our civilization has been extended to Mars, that radiation issue is going to have to be addressed.
And you would think that it would be an easy thing to address by comparison to some of the other problems. But
yeah.
for whatever reason, it has not been. You think, we just build shields. Well, it turns out some of the best shielding is very, very heavy. You know,
right.
I mean, you could put enough lead around a ship to fully protect those guys. But can you imagine how heavy it would be? That's part of the issue, So.
Or we just have to become genetically modified so we're radiation proof.
Or we can or fix it to where, if we get good enough at fixing the damage, we just take the damage on the trip there and then we get treatment, when we arrive, that kind of thing. All of these are possibilities, right? So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway,
okay,
well.
Would you go? The thing is, if you got kids, you can't. That's the problem. I mean.
Yeah, that's right. I would not.
Say you were single, right? Say you were single. You didn't have a wife and children. Would you go?
Well, not at this age. If I were 60 and were childless let's imagine me, Stephen, in 20 years, would I go? I'm 60 in 20, in 20 or so years. So would I go then? I wouldn't go because I would have grandchildren, I would want to be with and to be around. I probably would not go even under those circumstances. And but that's I've got those ties. There are I'm sure some guys out there that would go. Even if they had grandchildren, they'd take off. But it just depends, So
yeah,
I can imagine sending some couples,
Couples would be a good way to go. But I think if I had never been married and I had no children, and they asked me if I wanted to go, I think I'd go.
Yeah.
Although I'd want to clarify that they're sure they meant me. Because I'm not really the most qualified probably to do something like that. I'm not even very good at camping and things, so I don't know about like setting up a
setting up a new planet,
Yeah, I don't know about opening up a new planet for humanity, but I would be sorely tempted. Except for the fact, obviously, in real life I couldn't, because I would never think of leaving my children behind and eventually grandchildren, and if you're a dad, you got to be there for your family. So it really wouldn't apply to. How about folks in the chat room? Anyone jumping on and saying, "Hey, I'd go in a heartbeat." So far, no. Well, I know people who would go are out there. But,
yeah, there are plenty that would go, and of course you would NASA or whoever is in charge of this would not pick the typical 60-year-old. These 60-year-olds would be like those guys on the commercial you see with they're all buff and everything. These would be 60-year-olds in as good a shape as your average 60-year-old probably.
Absolutely. Well, here DC says if we sent couples, I'd ask my wife to shield me from the radiation. She owes me a few favors anyway. So, there you go. There you go. DC and Mrs. DC. Okay. Well, if anyone from NASA is listening, we got. Potentially two volunteers here. I'm not sure. It might just be one. We'll have to hear the whole rest of that story.
After Mrs. DC hears that comment, it probably just will be DC. But anyway.
Yeah, it might just be DC, and he might need to get away from town for a while anyhow. So this could work out. All right. I got a question for you, Stephen. True or false, do you agree with this statement? We cannot improve what we cannot measure.
I think that's by and large true. I think that's exactly – and I want, and it comes down to something as basic as just the most basic sort of evolution in life. Basically, the reason that life works at all is because it gets tried. Certain things get tried and they work out and they're passed on to the next generation. And then some things get tried and they don't work out and therefore they don't get passed on to the next generation. That is a form of measurement.
That's right. It's like the results are being recorded. They're being embedded, right?
That's right. If you were not embedding the information within DNA, or RNA, before DNA was RNA, if information was not being embedded in life, then there could be no improvement at all, if it's not being passed on to the next generation. Yeah,
exactly.
You wrote a very interesting post at the Speculist about exactly that.
Well, this is something that has been a major factor in my work, actually, in my professional life over the years. That saying, as I pointed out, I'm a little flippant in my writing style when I talk about total quality management and business process reengineering. But those are actually serious disciplines, and Six Sigma is these are serious processes whereby. Businesses make real efforts to kind of use a scientific approach to get better results. And I feel especially bad that if I seem flippant about W. Edwards Deming, that guy was a genius. In fact, you may remember in the 80s and early 90s, there was this kind of fad around Japanese management in the U.S.
Right.
We were gonna learn all these...
Just in time.
Yeah.
Techniques, yeah.
Going to learn all these Japanese management techniques. Well, now some of that truly was Japanese culture. And there's a book called Kaizen, which talks about that. And there really were significant ideas from developed in Japan that factored into that. But the great majority of Japanese management that was imported to the U.S. was developed by W. Edwards Deming. Back in the 40s, and no one listened to him. Nobody cared. They weren't interested. And he took his ideas to Japan. They adopted them, and they became this huge economic powerhouse because the notion of using process management and statistical quality control made perfect sense to them. And they went from being a minor industrial power, a second-rate, I should say, industrial power, to being this manufacturing powerhouse. And technological leader, partly due to their culture, but in large part due to the work of this guy. And it's interesting that the Deming Prize, which is kind of the Nobel Prize of business process performance improvement, is awarded in Tokyo every year. So he's kind of, you know, he is like this this guy who really understood what needs to happen to put a serious, rigorous method in place to improve business performance. And I think the record of post-war Japan in areas like manufacturing and high tech pretty much speaks for itself. If you look at that and you go, yep, those people made some improvements there, right?
They went so fast from, you know, from the manufacture of plastic trinkets you buy in the back of a comic book to, you know, integrated circuits. It blew us away. I mean,
in things like automobiles, where they went from, there was a time when made in Japan meant it was junk, that you wouldn't want a Japanese car because that was a piece of junk, to producing the finest, most high-tech cars in the world. To now, today, where, you know, all the difficulties that Toyota's had over the couple of years. But yeah, there was that period where they were adopting those techniques, and the transition was just absolutely astounding. And what made the difference? Well, the difference was they were following a very simple but very elegant methodology of recording results, proposing hypotheses, testing hypotheses, recording the results of those, figuring out what worked, and from each incremental improvement, repeating that process. And, you know, as I said, the record speaks for itself. Well, I've spent many years being part of that, working in telecom, and I've tried to integrate a lot of that thinking into work I've done subsequently, and it also, I think, factors into a lot of what we do at The Speculist. But it's really gotten my attention reading up on Kevin Kelly, who we got talking about because we didn't spend any time on it last week, but I guess you've just finished reading his book, What Technology Wants, about which I wrote a blog post the prior week.
Right.
And that book is not about measurement and improvement, although I think it probably I think those ideas are probably touched on there.
But no, it's not central to the book, no.
Yeah, but as I was reading about Kevin Kelly, and another of his ideas that he's been promoting for some time is this idea of the quantified self, which also Christine Peterson talked about when we were talking about the Personalized Life Extension Conference a couple months ago.
And no, it's interesting that this has been has been rattling around in your head ever since we talked to Christine, which has been a long time, because I have something that she kind of mentioned in passing, and I've been thinking about it for months as well. It's just one of those things, that whole idea that if the more aspects of our lives that we measure, the greater the opportunity for improvement. Measurement doesn't guarantee improvement, you know, as anyone who owns a bathroom scale could tell you.
Right.
But you're a whole lot less likely to lose weight if you don't have a bathroom scale. You know, you've removed the opportunity. You know, if you chunk the bathroom scale, you have removed the opportunity of losing weight almost. You know, it's just the very fact that you can measure it all creates an opportunity for improvement that wasn't there before.
Exactly. The thing is, I think we're at the beginning of a huge surge in interest in doing this. If you go to Kevin Kelly's site, the blog about the quantified self, and click on the resources page and look at the list of sites, tools, communities available to help people track and measure various aspects of their lives, it's really kind of overwhelming. I was really astounded. I had no idea how big this had actually gotten. I think really in just a matter of a few years. And it's of interest to me because, as I mentioned in the article, in the blog post, a good friend of mine, a fellow named Chris Twyman, is CEO of a company that has put something similar in place. Zappoint.com has taken the idea of the resume and kind of expanded that out into a whole life map. And I've got a JPEG of my personal life map on there, and I suggest everyone go to zappoint.com, and for free, this is a no-charge thing. You can, rather than writing up a written, here's the story of my life so far, you can create this really interesting, interactive, visual picture of what your life has been up to this point. And I feel that that having those kind of quantitative tools and that ability to take a different look at it than what you've had before alone probably provides a new perspective and will be helpful to people going forward. But the thing I mentioned in the blog post and that I had mentioned to Chris is that what I really want to see with this thing is everything to the it's like all your skills, they all build up, and you got this great colorful curve going up of getting more and more skilled, and here's all my accomplishments, and it all looks really great, and then it just stops. And the moment it stops, of course, is the present. Right? The whole thing is leading up to this moment, and then it's done. And I look at that, I say, what I want to be able to do now is, having quantified my life, is I want to start projecting where it's going. Because it seems to me that that's where all these quantified self efforts are aimed. Even the really simple ones. If people are trying to lose weight, people tracking their sleep, people tracking their exercise, their workouts, the most basic kinds of things. There's one called Tweet What You Eat, where people are just twittering every single thing they eat to keep track of what they're eating. I think all of these are very much future focused. These are all efforts that people are making to improve themselves over time. So my challenge to Chris is to find a way to allow people to provide a projected picture to the right of the present on the timeline. But I think generally we're going to see people doing amazing things with their lives just based on the fact that they've got new tools available to do it. I wouldn't be surprised if people start making some Japan-like transitions in their lives just based on the fact that that the methodology is there now.
Well, okay, we've got to bring the future into focus real quick then on this whole idea of measuring. Phil, give me one example of a technique that will allow us to quantify aspects of our life that you would expect to see in the future here.
You know what? You dropped just for a second there on that question. I missed. Could you repeat that?
Yeah. No problem. What piece of technology or process would you expect to see in the next, say, 5 years that would help us quantify or measure our lives in some productive way?
Well, I think I think there are numerous examples of them. What I would expect to see really making a difference is probably some kind of aggregation of a number of these tools, and just it's more like social networking, that phenomenon. Not so much a huge technological development as just a kind of a change in how people interact with each other because the technology allows it. I think what we're going to see is a change in how people interact with their lives because the technology allows it. And what we'll see, I predict, over the next few years is a much, much greater emphasis on measuring, tracking, and improving our lives using these kinds of tools than we've seen in the past. I think we are at the very beginning of this, and that this is going to be a bigger wave than even social networking was. I think this is going to be huge.
Well, let me just throw out something that I think I hope to see in the next few years. And this may be beyond the five-year horizon, but this may be 20 years from now, but what I would hope to see at some point would be, for medical purposes, would be an on-board doctor. That is, sitting within our body and can make recommendations that, you need to for optimal health, you need to consume this, or you need, we see that you're low on vitamin this or that, and you recommend these foods, we see you're developing an infection in this part of your body, take this medicine, basically,
yeah,
an
what you're saying
computer.
is the innate intelligence to do some of the other activities that are in that cycle of improvement. Because right now what people are doing is they're recording results and they're having to come up with all the ideas for improvement pretty much on their own or from what they get from each other. But you're talking about taking the intelligence to say, here's the next step, here's another thing to try, or here's the correct remediation for the current thing you're experiencing built right into the system.
Exactly. And,
yeah.
You know, you
I
can
agree.
Choose
that,
to do it or not do it. You know, you could ignore the advice given, as I'm sure a lot of people would do, but it's, you know, at least you'd have the information. You'd understand what I could do to improve this, you know, whatever the situation you're facing. So
I like it, Stephen. You incrementally improved my prediction of the future. So due to our ability to measure what we're talking about. Well, listen, we're very close on our time. Maybe should we switch to the music now, or
I think so.
Hey, before we do, just a quick. Well, go ahead and say the music, and then I'll say what I'm going to say.
Okay. All right. Our music tonight is Gone Tonight by Alvin. We'll be gone tonight after the song. So,
all right, Alvin, what?
I think it might be Albine Low.
Okay, singing Gone Tonight. We will be gone next week, but we will be on live on Tuesday, not Wednesday. No Monday night show, and we'll be back on Saturday, and we'll also be on this coming Saturday. So, we'll enjoy listening to Gone Tonight. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen, and thanks to everyone who participated in this evening's show. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back with you again on Saturday. Until then, live to see it.
Yesterday something was wrong when I was on my way to you. I was talking to your mother. She was crying because of your brother. I know, my friend, we don't understand. Please be strong, cause I can feel the pain you have. It feels so wrong. And I know every time it hurts to say goodbye. We don't understand what we have until we lost the one. That's why I think you shouldn't be left alone. I wish we could rewind the time. Every morning, every evening, every day, he always prayed for you, he prayed for you to stay. We don't really understand everything around us at all, some things are just meant to be. Yes, we gotta move on. Tonight, you cry tonight.